It's not that good. I mean, 70%, 75, 80% even is great when you talk about the fact that you managed to predict this. But to actually use it for something else, is 80% in the or 70% in the court cases where human rights are at stake, is that high enough?
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking more about the use of machine learning to predict court decisions. And for this, I'm joined by Masha Medvedeva. Masha is a computational linguist and an interdisciplinary PhD candidate at the Center for Language and Cognition and at the Department of Legal Methods at the University of Groningen, where she is working on automatic forecasting and classifying of judicial decisions. Masha, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as courts increasingly adhere to the directive to promote accessibility and reuse of public sector information and publish considered cases online, the door for automatic analysis of legal data is wide open. Now, the idea of automation and semi-automation in the legal domain is really nothing new at all. And in the age of legal big data, more and more researchers have started to notice the potential for machine learning in making more sense of the legal domain. Now, to really kick off this episode, can you give us a brief insight into the use and potential of machine learning in the legal domain?
So, legal domain is big, and I work primarily with case law. And to be honest, even this subfield is growing a lot faster than we can track. So, in terms of machine learning, And in terms of prediction research, for instance, I'll give example with a Dutch case law or what kind of things we can do. For instance, we work with eviction cases for Dutch law and evict project. And there's a lot of things you could do without machine learning, which is also automation. But then the machine learning allows for more exploratory research and a lot of things that cannot be done by just extracting information. And for instance, we have all published Dutch case law, which we can just download from rechtsbank.nl, but then we want eviction cases themselves, right? That's not a trivial task. Then if we do find the eviction cases, probably using machine learning, then, for instance, we would want to find all eviction cases that are drug-related, right? Or we want to find all eviction cases which did not end in eviction because kids were involved, right? So there's a lot of stages that you can go through to use for smaller or the bigger tasks, machine learning for smaller or bigger tasks. And again, when I'm talking about machine learning and case law, I talk about natural language processing, so specifically working with text. But basically, any sort of extracting, analyzing legal information can be done with machine learning or without. I think through this talk, I will insist on the fact that you should not use machine learning for everything. But yeah, for instance, these things.
Yeah, so I take it there are like many ways in which you can process such case law. And one of those methods, as you said, is machine learning. Now, my technical background isn't that great. How does machine learning exactly work?
So again, I will talk about machine learning in terms of a natural language processing and working with text, because machine learning can be used for all kinds of data. So basically, the way that we process a case law for prediction research, basically you have a task, you have your input data, and you have a label, right? So let's say we want to predict court decisions. Our data will be, depends on the court, maybe the judgments of the court from the, if we want to predict Supreme Court decisions, we'll take a court of appeal decisions, take that text, look at the facts in those cases and see which facts belong more to one label or to the other, whether the court will affirm the decision or not, right? And the machine learning works in such a way, again, with the text classification, that it can look at the text in a variety of different ways and analyze which parts of the text belong to which class.
Yeah, exactly. And then in the legal domain, you would most likely use natural language processing because it's mostly text-based.
Yeah, of course you can analyze recordings of proceedings as well, audio, but you will probably first make it into the text and then process it. But they can be, I'd say for the legal domain, it's mostly text.
Okay, now I think it's very clear, you know, nowadays that legal technology especially is gaining a lot of interest. And part of that is also, you know, through the use of, for example, machine learning or in this case, natural language processing. And many law firms and government organizations use tools to automate, speed up or simplify their work. And one of the subjects that the field of AI and law is fascinated with is making a fair and unbiased decision-making system that would be able to assist judges in their decision-making or even replace them in court. Now, at present, at least from what I understood from your research, is that techniques for machine learning have not often been used in the legal domain. But you wrote a computer program that analyzes texts of judgments of the European Court of Human Rights cases available on the court's website, which predicts any particular article of the European Convention on Human Rights was violated. Without delving too deep into the technical details of the program, how does the program work and what led you to create this program?
How does this program work? So it works in a very similar way that I described for how natural language processing for in legal domain works in general. In our case, we tackle two tasks, actually. We tackle classifying final decisions of the European Court of Human Rights and predicting future decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. We use similar methods, though, but we use different data for that. So basically, for classifying final decisions, we take the decisions of that are published by the court, and take the facts out of those cases, and again, look at different words and phrases within those texts, apply an algorithm that weighs these words to estimate whether they are predictors for violation or no violation, and then have an algorithm that trains on all the cases from the European Court of Human Rights and tries to predict or classify the newer cases into the ones having violation or no violation. Why do you do that in the first place, classifying final judgment? One thing that machine learning allows you to do is to explore things that might not be obvious to a person. Basically, we want to see whether by using machine learning, we can see which facts in the case it finds more important for one verdict or the other, and then maybe find some patterns that were not clear to a human before. So that would be a task of classifying final decisions. And then predicting pending decisions can, of course, be important for an applicant, for a general understanding of how decision-making process works, where we take the cases that are published. So basically, these are the documents that are published before the final decision is made, sometimes years before. They're called communicated cases. And then we analyze the facts in those cases, which are the summary of the events that applicant described to the court, basically. And we analyze those facts and try to see how the court will judge later.
And I was also wondering, because you say you feed the algorithm data, I think it's also, you know, characteristic for something like machine learning or natural language processing that the algorithm has to be fed with data. And, mm-hmm. you know, a court case obviously contains a lot of data. Was there also data that you left out for any specific reasons?
So basically, with classifying final decisions, we only use the facts of the case. So basically, for European Court of Human Rights, they have quite a structured case law. So basically, in the beginning, they would have information about who the judges are, the chamber, the applicant, like both parties. And then they state the facts of the case, which they get from the applicant and after investigation. And then they have the part which is called the law, where the court provides their argument for a certain decision. And then we have the verdict, right? And then we exclude the verdict because this is what we're trying to find that. But we also exclude the law because in our research, we're not interested in the arguments. We're interested whether we can identify the facts of what happened and how that influences a particular decision. So, of course, with the classification task like that, if you train the system on the arguments of the case, you can also maybe find out which arguments are more important for the court, for the machine learning system, right? And maybe those might be more important for the court, right? But the problem with the data with this court is that the law part also contains the verdict, because the court says, the court thinks that there was a violation of Article 3 of the convention because this, this, and that, right? And one thing with the machine learning algorithms, they take everything they get. Right. So if you have this information in the court case, it will just learn to find that kind of information. Right. There's a multiple ways of still doing that. You can remove this kind of information from the text and so on. But we are specifically interested in the facts. So we take the facts of the case and then we classify the decisions. And when we then if we have high enough scores, it means our system works quite well. And then we can go back and see, okay, when working so well, what does the system find important? And then we can make some assumptions about what the court finds important.
Yeah, exactly. And the program that you wrote eventually led to the creation of Yuri Says. And that online application predicts judgments of the ECTHR with an overall accuracy of what I saw at least 70% or more. And Yuri reads published documents from previous years and decisions of cases judged by the European Court of Human Rights and then predicts the decisions the court will make while simultaneously learning from the mistakes it makes. So you said just before there's either violation or not, and then I think Yuri Says decides violation or not, and if it makes a mistake, it learns from those mistakes as well.
We retrain the system every month to add the new cases because there's an expectation that the court judges differently over time. The one thing that this court has that a lot of low and national courts will not have is that the law doesn't change. The Convention on Human Rights has some modifications, but very minor. It does not really change the articles of the convention in a very long time. But at the same time, what was considered torture 30 years ago and what is considered torture today, there's an article on prohibition of torture, are very different things. And we expect the judges to move on with time, right?
Yeah.
So, and we did some experiments to see whether like predicting long in the future is harder, and it is. But also because machine learning systems, again, they take everything they have and they don't have anything else, right? They don't actually have any knowledge of the world. So if there's new concepts in the world, the machine learning has no way of finding it until you give it to it. So there is, for instance, a right for private life and correspondence. And correspondence 30 years ago and today are very different things. If the system has never seen a word WhatsApp, how can it predict anything regarding WhatsApp?
Yeah, so that would be a real pitfall of the system that you said also just before, for example, torture. So Yuri Says in this case, for example, wouldn't be able to understand the difference in context.
So we hope that because we keep updating the system, they will learn more and more with each month. And of course, we predict for the next month and we see how the model performed. And then if we predicted something wrong, we will edit into the system correctly. And hopefully the system will learn that this was supposed to be a violation or no violation, depending on the case, right? But the difference with the others, at least with the European Court of Human Rights, there's actually very, very few papers, at least in the academia, that actually forecast future decisions. There's a lot of research on classifying the final decisions, as I mentioned before, but there's very little research that uses information that is available before the decision, like the final judgment is made, to actually predict the judgment. There is some research on Supreme Court in the United States, and we've seen a one for German tax law appeal cases. So there's really not that much, mostly because courts don't publish submissions by the parties. A lot of courts publish Supreme Court decisions, but not every appeal court decision, right? So you can't have the information from previous stages.
Yeah, so is that also, I think, the reason why you chose for the European Court of Human Rights?
Mm-hmm.
And I was also wondering, because I think it's really fascinating that you built like this whole program. Why did you decide to do this? Like, why did they decide at the department to start on this, the building of this?
Well, when we started this, we could see that there is something starting there in this predicting court decisions. And there was this idea of, in general, merging natural language processing with the law. I am actually working for two departments, really, in the Faculty of Arts and the Faculty of Law. And actually, very lucky, I truly think so, to work with a computational linguist. I'm a computational linguist, and lawyers, because there's actually a lot of research. The way that things sometimes are done in natural language processing, you have data, you want to do something with it. It's exciting. Predicting court decisions is exciting. It's very, can be very scandalous, can be very sensational, you know? And then you actually start looking at the data and understand, ooh, I actually need to know some law to understand how this works, so to interpret what my system does and so on. So I'm very lucky to be able to work with people from both fields. I think in general in this research, that's how it should be done. It's not always the case. So there was this idea of collaboration first, and then we decided to do this a bit sensational research, but to specifically focus also not on just predicting court decisions, but doing some decent legal research and seeing how we can improve it. Also, I've seen around the world some law departments, and they could use some innovation.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm wondering, because I can imagine that from your perspective as a computational linguist, this is really exciting. What were the reactions from the legal side to, not necessarily from your department, because they obviously agreed to do this, but from, for example, courts? I don't know if you looked at what their reaction was to such a system as Yuri says, and how did they react to this?
I think a lot of people are skeptical, understandably. I am also often skeptical. Maybe we'll talk about it later. I, in general, don't think that these systems should be used in courts, and we repeat that in every moment that we can. So, in general, there's a lot of enthusiasm. Everybody can see the potential. There's a lot of skepticism because, well, it's new. It's not that good. I mean, 70%, 75%, 80% even, is great when you talk about the fact that you managed to predict this, but to actually use it for something else is 80% in the, or 70% in the court cases where human rights are at stake. Is that high enough? I don't know. I don't think so. Also, there has to be a lot of discussion what it is used for. For us, it's legal research. We want to find out what influences certain decisions, right? There's a, for a lot of other tasks, there's a lot of different applications. But here, as exciting as it sounds, we just want to know how this works in human terms.
Yeah, exactly. And you already mentioned, you know, there are some worries, and you said that you wouldn't advise to use such a system in actual practice. And I read in your paper that there were a couple of specific dangers that you foresee. So you mentioned, for example, the risk of misinterpreting decision predicting as decision making, an unavoidable inherent status quo bias, and the danger of reverse engineering. I'd love to hear more about, like, why do you see these as dangers, and if you could elaborate more on this.
First of all, I'd like to note straight away that I think there's a lot more dangers. These are just that we can see from the technical perspective when just looking at the data and the way that machine learning works. So, yes, this is what we see a lot, that people hear predicting court decisions, they say robo-judge. This is immediate connection, which from our perspective is absolutely not there. Because, yes, so we really want to clearly distinguish between a decision making and decision predicting. The way that machine learning works for predicting court decisions, classifying court decisions, is that it takes old information from old cases, learns something from it, which is often not very well explainable from the human perspective, and gives something out. There is no step-by-step explanation. If this is the fact, this is what the argument of the judge will be, the argument of the judge, this is what the decision is. There is no with machine learning at this stage that it is and at the level of research in legal domain right now, it's just guessing. It's educated guess, but it's still a guess. And it's not... So we can guess what will be, but we cannot say do this. It's a very different task. And of course, the machine learning system learns from old cases. And with URI-CES, for instance, we try to update it every month and so on. But we update it because the judges make new decisions. But the machine learning system cannot just make new decisions. It's sort of set in its ways. There's a status quo bias in a real court as well, often, right? But there's, for machine learning, there's absolutely no way to get out of it because it only has what it was given. And so it cannot make any new decision. And the other issue is, reverse engineering and generally a cybersecurity concern. What is my personal biggest concern is adversarial machine learning. Adversarial machine learning allows you to sort of reverse engineer certain things with malicious intent. So basically the reason that you still get spam sometimes, even though the systems to prevent you from that, Google has a whole bunch of it and invests a lot of money in it, and still this is happening, is because adversarial machine learning develops at the same speed as any machine learned system. And a very simple example of how adversarial machine learning could cause issue in the court is that I like to step away from the court and give an example of a cookie machine, because more people can relate, at least outside of the legal domain. Basically, let's have a hypothetical example where you have a cookie machine, which if you want a cookie, it asks you a whole bunch of questions about your history of eating cookies, whether you had fruit for breakfast and whatever. And based on your answer, it gives you a cookie or not. So it asks you all the questions, you answer, and you're denied a cookie. You're upset, you demand justice. So you want to know what happened and why. And if the machine is not explainable, if the program that gives you the cookie is not explainable, then you immediately deny justice, right? You don't understand what happened and you can't get your cookie. If the system is explainable, it might provide you with the answers on how it weighed your answers. Maybe it had some information from your previous cookie eating, and it provides you with information on how it made a decision. Now, I as a programmer, or any of my programmer friends, know how the system works. So next time any of them go to the machine, they write a little program that finds out how to answer the question in such a way that you'll receive a cookie. Yeah, this is adversarial machine learning in this essence. So the problem there is that, of course, it can be explainable, just not provide information to you, right? That's one of the sort of solution. The problem is if the system is consistent enough, and you have enough data, enough people who tried the cookies, for instance, in the law firm has a lot of data about cookies, apparently, then you can build a system that understands this consistency and predicts it even without this information provided to you. And in reality, of course, we want a consistent system, but then it can be hacked in this way. And if the system is inconsistent, why would you want a roulette in a court?
Yeah, no, exactly. But would that mean then that in this particular case, so applying the cookie example to the legal domain, that, for example, a lawyer who's on a particular case would then, you know, find these patterns and then use it to his benefit, knowing that, oh, if I do this or that, then I know that the judge would rule this or that in a particular case.
For instance, can also be, for the prosecutor. So basically, if the system is consistent, and of course you want a real court to be consistent as well, but the judge can get some extra information from the outside. They could be sympathetic to the victim or a perpetrator for one reason or another. It can have information about how things are different today from yesterday. It can consult with their colleagues, right? It could learn something new every day. And the machine system like that will be consistent to a fault. So you can really get 100% accuracy with such a system if you build a good enough one.
And also linking, by the way, to that point of a judge who might feel for somebody who's standing in front of him or her, such an algorithm, I think it doesn't have that capability to live with.
It just has the text, right? And I guess in the court, if it was a decision-making system, again, this is not what we're building.
Exactly.
It would probably have to use some information with the submission of the parties, right? Some sort of facts of the case. There's, of course, a long list of ethical considerations of whether it is appropriate to do so as well. But from a technical perspective, it's a lot easier to hack a machine than to hack a judge, even though, of course, you can, to some degree, hack a judge as well.
Definitely. That is nothing new. And also talking about that, or not necessarily that point, but something in the same line. I can imagine that there are people out there that say, you know, why should we be worried about this? Because, you know, these situations, for example, that the danger of reverse engineering, it already exists in practice without such machines predicting or helping us or anything in that sense. Is it then really something we have to be worried about? Or
I think so, again, because of like the degree to which you can do it. Again, the judge might be, and hopefully is quite consistent, but it still has a free will to interpret the facts in different ways. It's also different judges interpret facts in different ways, and usually none of them are wrong, right? And the machine learning system will not have that capacity. Not to say that such systems should not be used for legal assistance. That's actually, I think, where the world is heading. But decision-making, not at this point, not at all.
Yeah, so also wondering, that's a little bit outside of necessarily this point, but you're talking about judges and they have their own will. And we were speaking about the data before. I think you said, or I read something about the fact that you had like a specific test where you would also include the names of judges.
This is ethically arguable. The reason for that, I think we processed it decently. The reason for that is that, again, the sensationalism of such research, people jump to conclusion quite quickly with these things because they sort of expect, I guess, some judges to have biases. And so, yeah, what we did was for the European Court of Human Rights, we took the names of the judges and tries to see whether we can predict the decision based on that alone. And not very well, but we could do better than chance. But it's very important to point out that this does not mean at all that these judges have biases. The way that machine learning works is that it can associate certain things, certain input with a certain label. And in this, at this point, it associated the names of the judges with the label. But why the judges are there is a different question. So basically, for instance, the way the European Court of Human Rights has the judges' composition is that the judge from the country that is being sued for the violation of human rights has to be on the panel. And the panel of judges, like there's a chambers which contain a certain judges that sometimes rotate. So there will be a set of judges for specific countries, unless it's a grand chamber where a lot more judges are. So if some country is a notorious violator of a specific human right, then the judge from that country will always be on those cases. And this judge might often judge for violation because that country is a violator of human rights. It does not make that judge biased at all. But we picked up in our data that this judge is often on the cases with violation. So the system learned it. This is also a demonstrator between decision predicting and decision making. We can predict that based on the judge. But if the judge is there, it doesn't mean that we should make a decision for violation.
No, exactly. That's a really good point and also really interesting, actually. And I guess also kind of a bit of a danger, I guess, if you would consider such a system as a decision making system rather than a decision predicting system. So it's like a danger resulting from a danger.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, something else that relates to your point that you said, like, you know, we shouldn't use these systems always. In what cases would you consider, for example, Yuri says, if it would be used to, you know, predict decisions, not, or when shouldn't we use such systems?
For anything other than legal research, to be honest. What we're doing is academic research. We made this nice program where you can look at how we do it. And I think it can be educational. It can be interesting to see in our system. We, for instance, highlight the sentences that are predictors for, not necessarily sentences and facts, that are predictors for certain judgments. So anybody can go and have a look at how such a machine learning system works. So again, for us, this is pattern identification and legal analysis. There's a lot of research out there that starts focusing on legal assistance, which can come out also if we find these patterns, then that information can be used to help judges make their decisions. But from what we see in the nearest future, and I think in quite a long future, there will always have to be a human in the loop, what we call. Even if there's some assistance, there has to be a person reviewing it. And this assistance have to be in such a way that it doesn't actually strongly suggest the final decision. Because it seems like we can see with some American courts that they use systems that suggest whether a person should get bail or go to prison. And then there was some research that shows that the judges also use it for sentencing, because they think, okay, if they basically it's the system that predicts whether a person will reoffend if they get bail, and if the judge sees, okay, the system says that 9 out of 10 this person will reoffend, why would I let him out? I'll give him the longest possible sentence. Right. But this is, of course, not always the case, but this is a danger of what can happen with the assistant tools as well, that they will be used as decision making systems.
Yeah, exactly. So it just comes to show how dangerous it can be to use such, at least now, at this present point in time, on its own to judge in a specific case.
At the same time, I recently had a chance to talk to a judge, a Dutch judge, and she made a very good point. She said, I don't have an assistant, but I could. And why not have an automatic assistant that could summarize facts for me? Or if it's good enough, it might be better than my human assistant. Maybe my human assistant is not that great, right? So why not use that? And I really like that point. People are allowed to have assistants that help them with the caseload and so on, right? So why not? It's just very important to understand what this is for. And also important to understand while developing the systems, because this is also, there's an issue with the word predicting. Predicting in natural language processing, it's part of the whole machine learning lingo, where we have this input data and we predict a label, taking this educated guess. But then you say predicting court decisions and everybody think that you can actually predict something in the future. That's why we try to use the word forecasting now. But yeah, there's in research as well, there has to be a lot clearer guidelines to how to conduct this kind of research. But it's very new, so we get there.
Exactly. And also like talking then about more towards the future, and I'll also try to wrap it up here. Where do you then see Yuri Says in the next decade or so, or a couple of years from now? Where do you see it heading?
So my ultimate hope is that me or my colleagues will eventually be able to identify in legal terms what matters for decision making for this particular court in terms of facts, and maybe in terms of arguments that the court makes, identifying arguments. That's a very hard task, but for now we're trying to sort of have the fundamentals of how such research should be conducted and so on. But yeah, the hope is that it sort of once again gives way for this exploratory research where you can find something that legal researchers just reading through text, the limited amount of text that they can read, cannot identify, and that the machine might be able to.
Yeah, exactly. And solution-wise, for like the dangers that you see, have you got any idea like what solutions would be?
I think people have to learn about how this works. I think a general education is good. There is more and more studies around the world that do AI and law from the technical and from the legal perspective. There has to be a lot more regulations about it. There's a lot of research in that as well. Not an expert in that, but there's definitely the attempts to somehow make some guidelines for these things.
Sounds like a good call to action. And on that note, Masha, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast. Yeah.